Well, hello there. Welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I have a whole slew of articles to read this week, and so let's get started right now with the must list. Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole leading a unique ghost story. The action-packed Invincible Season 4 finale and Apex top this week's must list. Hayley Williams' Ego Death Tour and Kenrex round out our picks for the weekend. This is by Tiffany Kelly. This week has been a lot for me. I moved, I turned 40, I got my first cavity filled. To say it's been chaotic is an understatement. And what I'm dealing with is nothing compared to what many are. It struck me as I sat amongst the many, many boxes on Sunday that the first thing I should do is set up the TV. Nothing like watching some Shark Tank while eating takeout and avoiding opening that next box to make you instantly feel at ease. I hope pop culture does that for you too, and by proxy, the work we do here at Entertainment Weekly. If not, good Indian takeout also does the trick. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First on our list is Mother Mary. Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole are mesmerizing in David Lowery's haunting new film in theaters as a pop star and a costume designer, respectively, who dissect their once close friendship after years of not speaking to each other. In a dark, moody barn, the two share connected ghost stories and open up old wounds. The film's original songs, written by Jack Antonoff, Charlie XCX, and FKA Twigs, who also has a small but memorable role, are great, but Mother Mary is at its best when focused on Hathaway's titular star and Cole's Sam Anslem, whose intense bond is felt through the screen. Invincible is number two on the list. The Prime Video series proves its might with a doozy of a season four finale. Following the penultimate episode's Deep Space Bloodbath, the last confrontation between Thrag, played by Lee Pace, and Mark, played by Steven Yeun, although lacking violence, is one of the season's most intense standoffs. Apex is number three. Taron Egerton goes hunting for Charlize Theron in this heart-pounding, outback-set twist on The Most Dangerous Game, now streaming on Netflix. If you love movies that turn your palms sweaty and leave you gasping for air, this is the one for you. Hayley Williams' Ego Death Tour. Whether she's in some racist country singer's bar or selling out multiple nights in New York City, Williams is always the biggest star. The Paramore frontwoman is currently on tour to celebrate her third album. If you can grab a ticket, go. Miss Paramore is truly at the top of her game. And the last item, number five on our list, is Kenrex. Jack Holden brings his extraordinary Olivier-winning performance to New York City's Lucille Lortel Theater, playing 35 different characters in a frenetic, true crime thriller that will shake your brain and rattle your soul. Holden is mesmerizing in a truly must-see breakout role. Well, roles. That's our must list, Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole leading a unique ghost story, the action-packed Invincible Season 4 finale and Apex topping this week's list, and it was by Tiffany Kelly. Kind of a sidebar to the Apex movie, Charlize Theron scales billboard in New York Times Square to promote Netflix movie Apex. This is by a staff author. Charlize Theron just proved she performs her own stunts. On Friday, the Oscar winner scaled a massive billboard atop Times Square's Pentacular to promote Apex, her new action flick streaming now on Netflix. As curious New Yorkers watched from below on 7th Avenue, Theron, wearing a safety harness, of course, climbed a faux rock wall several stories high. At the summit, she waved to onlookers and danced as they cheered. "That's actually her?" marveled a pedestrian in a video captured by New York digital creator Mickey Blank. In Apex, Theron stars as a rock climber who finds herself being hunted by a serial killer played by Taron Egerton while stranded in the Australian outback. For the action-packed film, she trained with rock climber Beth Rodden, who famously ascended Yosemite's difficult meltdown surface. Hearing her story and her expertise, I thought, this is the most badass, best climber you could be with, Theron told Netflix. She's the OG. But she wasn't so convinced of her own capabilities. "I'd never climbed before, except as a kid in Africa climbing trees, which I loved," said Theron. "And weirdly, I climbed barefoot, so I was kind of prepping for this movie without knowing it." Theron began training on a rock climbing wall, and although strength and endurance are obviously a big part of it, so is instinct. "I just remember on the first day I would ask her, 'So, what should I do?'" recalled Theron. "I kept asking that a couple of times, and then it finally sank into me. Her response was always, 'I don't know.'" Along the way, the actress also channeled her character, Sasha, a widow who finds solace in climbing after the tragic death of her husband during one of their tandem excursions. "There were days that I would go, and I was going through stuff," she explained, "and it just felt like a way to forget about things." Apex is now streaming on Netflix, and you can watch the official trailer at the end of this article. That was Charlize Theron Scales Billboard in New York Times Square to promote Netflix movie Apex, and it was by a staff author. This was the top story. This next article was the top story when I opened up Entertainment Weekly to get ready to read. Stephen Colbert addresses rumors about his next move after Late Show cancellation. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert airs its final episode on Thursday, May 21st. This is by Marina Watts. Stephen Colbert is setting the record straight on what's next in the most Stephen Colbert way. During the Thursday, April 23rd episode of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, the eponymous host addressed what his plans are once his show wraps up in May. "After internet rumors continue to run wild," the late night host took charge of the narrative. "I've heard a lot of theories, everything from I'm moving to CNN to I'm announcing a massive wildlife rescue program to I'm running for president of the United States," Colbert said. "Now, here's the thing. I can reveal right now that all of those are partially true. Next year, I will be president of an animal sanctuary dedicated to caring for the rare Blitzer wolf. It's a captive breeding program. Nobody tell him," he joked of the seasoned CNN anchor. Colbert then pivoted to, quote-unquote, officially announce his next big television project with his signature serious delivery. "It's an hour-long network procedural drama torn straight from today's headlines. It's the gripping tale of two detectives who are also uncles. How can they be both? It ain't easy, folks." A trailer for the unfortunately fake buddy comedy, Uncle Cops, starring Colbert and John C. Reilly, starts playing. Uncles Mitch and Bob struggle to balance their high-demand roles as police officers while also be devoted, doting uncles. The show asks, "Where is the line between duty and love?" as the cops fight crime while balancing uncle duties such as forgetting their nephews' names and watching videos of music recitals. All jokes aside, Colbert does make a convincing uncle cop. After The Late Show ends, Colbert will be writing a new Lord of the Rings film that he and son Peter had pitched to Peter Jackson. "I did not think I would have the time, as much as I love it. I knew I couldn't do that and do this show at the same time, But it turns out, I'm going to be free starting this summer, Colbert quipped in March. CBS announced in July 2025 that The Late Show would be ending the following May. We consider Stephen Colbert irreplaceable and will retire the Late Show franchise at that time, CBS said in a statement at the time. We are proud that Stephen called CBS home. He and the broadcast will be remembered in the pantheon of greats that graced late night television. The statement continued, This is purely a financial decision against a challenging backdrop in late night. It is not related in any way to the show's performance, content, or other matters happening at Paramount. Colbert addressed the cancellation on his show not long after. It's not just the end of our show, but it's the end of The Late Show on CBS. I'm not being replaced. This is all just going away, he said at the time. Let me tell you, it is a fantastic job. I wish somebody else was getting it. And it's a job that I'm looking forward to doing with this usual gang of idiots for another 10 months. It's going to be fun. The last episode of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert airs on Thursday, May 21st on CBS. Starting May 22nd, Comics Unleashed with Byron Allen will take over Colbert's 11:35 Eastern and Pacific time slot. We can watch that Stephen Colbert Uncle Cops trailer because it's linked at the end of this article. That was Stephen Colbert addresses rumors about his next move after Late Show cancellation, and it was by Marina Watts. Here's why Sterling K. Brown considers his recent injury a blessing in disguise. This is by Emlyn Travis. Sterling K. Brown is revealing the sweet reason why he believes his recent Achilles injury was actually a blessing in disguise. The Paradise actor, 50, described the incident as the most fulfilling injury I've ever had because it allowed him to spend more quality time with his two young sons, Andrew, 14, and Amari, 10, whom he shares with his wife, Ryan Michelle Bath. For me, right now, the center of my life are these two boys that I adore like nobody's business, Brown said during a fireside chat with Shipt CMO Aaliyah Kemet in New York City. I had a forced rest recently where I tore my Achilles tendon, he said, and that was not the way that I wanted to have the rest, but it was a blessing in disguise in that I got a chance to spend a good 5, 6, 7 months just going to every soccer game, every practice, every basketball, every flag football game. Brown continued, It was the most fulfilling sort of injury that I've ever had because I took advantage of that time. So any time that I get with those two fellas is magic for me. Last September, Brown announced in an Instagram post that he'd torn his Achilles tendon while doing something athletic outside. Not even, like, super dangerous or anything. Just took a step and it felt like somebody stomped on the back of my heel, he remarked at the time. I was like, who stepped on me? Who stepped on me? And they're like, what are you talking about, man? That same month, Brown attended the Emmys wearing a cast on his left foot and utilized a knee scooter in order to present the award for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series with his Paradise co-stars. In addition to attending his son's sporting events, Brown, who is currently serving as Shipt's 2026 chief storyteller, revealed during the fireside chat that he's also a big fan of driving them to school every morning. They're boys, so they're a little close to the vest sometimes, but sometimes they're sitting in the car, they'll just start talking, he said. And it's like you sit and listen and take it in. It's the best. Although he doesn't always understand his son's current obsessions, like Amari's passion for tech decks, which are miniature skateboards for your fingers. That didn't stop him from trying to explain the toy to those in attendance, as well as to the chat's moderator, Allie Love. The youngest one is into this thing called tech deck, like fingerboards, Brown said. It's like a skateboard thing that they just do with their fingers. I mean, it's crazy. He continued, and I can't do it. Like, my fingers don't, like, he'll make it pop up in the air and do tricks and all this stuff. People who have kids my age, they know what I'm talking about. That was why Sterling K. Brown considers his recent injury a blessing in disguise, and it was by Emlyn Travis. The Michael movie is going to be out in just a couple days as I'm recording this. Here is Michael, Fact versus Fiction, Peter Pan, the Pepsi incident, and Michael Jackson's relationship with his dad. Entertainment Weekly breaks down Fact versus Fiction in Antoine Fuqua's musical biopic about the King of Pop. It's by Shania Russell. When it comes to grappling with the truth, Michael is already in murky territory. The long-awaited Michael Jackson biopic from director Antoine Fuqua has endured a troubled road to the big screen, with critics wondering how the project would handle the singer's complicated legacy and numerous allegations of child sex abuse. Long before audiences would see a glimpse of the film, Leaving Neverland director Dan Reed slammed the script as a complete whitewash of Jackson's complicated legacy. Then production hit a serious roadblock, reportedly requiring reshoots due to a clause in the singer's settlement with Jackson's accuser, Jordan Chandler. But thanks to its timeline, Michael never actually gets around to addressing those allegations, as the film focuses on the early years of Jackson's career and ultimately concludes in the late 80s. But how much truth is there to the details that are presented about Michael's rise to fame? Here, Entertainment Weekly explores several key points raised in Michael and the reality of the man behind the pop culture icon. The first is lying about his age. Jackson was 10 when the Jackson 5 signed with Motown Records, the company that would help them produce hits such as I Want You Back and ABC. But when the group was introduced to the world 1 year later, it was fronted by an 8-year-old prodigy. In that, Michael wasn't alone. All five boys, Michael, 11, Marlon, 12, Jermaine, 14, Tito, 15, and Jackie, 17, had 2 years shaved off their ages to emphasize the image that Motown wanted to present. Five talented wunderkinds singing years beyond their ages. Michael later reflected on this white lie to biographer J. Randy Taraborelli, who penned Michael Jackson, The Magic and the Madness. I figured out at an early age that if someone said something about me that wasn't true, it was a lie, Jackson said. But if someone said something about my image that wasn't true, then it was okay. Because then it wasn't a lie, it was public relations. Here's Michael's complicated relationship with dad Joe Jackson. As the biopic explores, Michael famously had a fraught relationship with his father, Joe Jackson, who served an all-in-one role as patriarch, coach, drill sergeant, and manager to his children. Joe not only encouraged his children to pursue careers in the entertainment biz, but also enforced long, intense rehearsal sessions, coaching them to hone their skills. In numerous interviews before his 2009 death, Michael outlined troubling childhood incidents with his father, often involving physical abuse. In the 2003 Martin Bashir documentary, Living with Michael Jackson, the Thriller singer opened up about enduring beatings from his father, who believed in using corporal punishment. Michael claimed his father sometimes watched the brothers rehearse with a belt in hand as a threat against making mistakes. Asked by Bashir how often Joe would hit him, the singer replied, "Too much." He added, "He'd throw you up against the wall as hard as you could. He would lose his temper. I was so fast, he couldn't catch me half the time. But when he could catch me, it was bad. It was really bad." As these stories emerged, Joe, who died in 2018, insisted he had no regrets over using physical punishment, telling Oprah Winfrey in 2010, "I'm glad I was tough because look what I came out with." As for Michael, the singer did publicly express gratitude for his father, including during an emotional conversation with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach via People, where he noted, "God bless my father because he did some wonderful things and he was brilliant. He was a genius." That said, Michael was not particularly close with Joseph in his later years, and per CBS, Joseph Jackson was omitted from his son's will, with all of Michael's assets going to his mother, his children, and various children's charities. Firing Joe via fax is the next segment. In the film, Michael severs professional ties with his father pretty quickly after coming into his own as a solo artist. He finds new representation in Miles Teller's John Branca, and as his first request, asks his new manager to fire his dad. According to Tara Borelli, who chronicled the singer's life in a 1991 biography, the dramatization wasn't too far off from reality. Tara Borelli wrote that Michael had Branca draw up official documents informing Joseph that his managerial services would no longer be required. Michael, who lived with his family, stayed out of the house while the documents were delivered by messenger, waiting for his father to absorb the news. When they finally met to discuss the matter, Michael brought along an advisor so that he wouldn't have to be alone with Joe. Summing it up, Jackson told Tara Borelli, "It's not easy firing your father." Afterward, Michael's brothers followed suit, firing Joseph as the manager of the Jackson 5, renamed the Jacksons, just 4 years later. Michael's monkey, giraffe, snake, and general love of animals. By the height of his career, Michael had garnered quite the reputation as an eccentric, a perception fueled by his collection of exotic pets. Just as the biopic shows, Michael adopted several animals that wouldn't typically be considered pet material. He owned a python, a llama, 4 giraffes, 2 tigers, flamingos, a parrot, a boa constrictor, and most notably, a chimpanzee named Bubbles. While several of the exotic pets resided on the singer's California ranch, Bubbles spent much of his time in Michael's close company. He was often photographed out and about at music video shoots, parties, and occasionally at events. When the chimpanzee matured and was no longer a suitable pet, he was moved to a Florida primate sanctuary where he resides to this day. Michael's obsession with Peter Pan. Jackson's affinity for Peter Pan was well documented. After purchasing his 2,700-acre Sycamore Valley Ranch, Jackson famously renamed the property Neverland, an homage to Never Never Land, the fantasy setting of the story about a boy who never ages. To capture the feeling of never growing up, Jackson also turned the property into a private amusement park. Later, Michael penned a song titled Peter Pan, which he'd recorded but never released. He did treat fans to an a cappella version, though, singing a snippet of the track during an interview. The Beat It dance session with 2 LA gangs. The 1983 music video for Beat It cast Michael Jackson as a peacemaker, using dance to quell a dispute between 2 rival gangs. Looking to infuse the video with authenticity and perhaps put his peacemaker persona to real-life use, the singer really did recruit members of Los Angeles's Crips and Bloods to dance in the video. Bob Giraldi, who wrote and directed the video, said this idea was 100% Michael's in a 2009 interview. He went out and he got him through, I guess, the LAPD's gang squad, and he convinced them that with enough police presence, this would be a smart and charitable thing to do, Giraldi shared. I didn't like the idea because it was hard enough to direct actors and dancers. But Michael insisted, and according to Giraldi, hoped he could get them to like each other if they hung out on set. While the final product speaks for itself, Giraldi said the shoot was challenging from the start. He claimed that the production was almost shut down the first night because film sets get to be very boring after the first hour. I guess the Crips and Bloods started to get on each other's nerves. They are mortal enemies. And we had a few incidents, he recalled. Two cops came to me and said they wanted to close it down. Giraldi said he managed to convince the officers to let him jump right to shooting the dance sequence where it all finally came together. The gang members couldn't dance, so they formed the ring and watched, he recalled. I remember looking at the faces of all the Crips and Bloods lined up in their expressions as they listened to that music and watched those kids dance. They had that look like, you know what? With all our wars and vendettas and stuff, that's cool right there. That's something we'll never be able to do. And that's what made that evening work. The Pepsi hair incident. Michael was 25 and at the pinnacle of his career when he joined his brothers for a Pepsi commercial in January 1984. The ad, which was part of a multi-million-dollar endorsement deal with PepsiCo, was filmed before a live studio audience that witnessed a pyrotechnics malfunction shower the superstar in sparks, prompting his heavily gelled hair to catch fire. Recounting the incident per the Los Angeles Times, Jackson's longtime hair and makeup artist, Karen Fay, said he continued dancing down the stairs, not initially realizing he was on fire. After a friend of the singer's rushed the stage and wrestled him to the ground to put the fire out, Fay recalled all his hair was gone and there was smoke coming out of his head. Jackson was taken to the hospital where he was treated for severe second and third degree burns to his scalp, per the BBC. He was eventually sent home with opioids to help with pain management. Footage of the incident was featured in the 2026 TMZ documentary Michael Jackson, 30 Fatal Seconds, which offered an in-depth look at the shocking incident and argued that it was the impetus for Jackson's self-image issues, drug abuse, and eventual fatal overdose in 2009. Jackson family lawyer Brian Panish said in the doc, "He underwent extensive plastic surgery, skin grafting, where they took skin from another part of his body to fix the areas that were damaged. He had severe pain, he had debilitating pain, he had neuropathic pain, which is nerve pain in the scalp. The pain led to anxiety. It led to, really, most importantly, loss of sleep. The pain, the inability to sleep, causes the pain to be worse." As for PepsiCo, Jackson declined to sue, and the two parties reached an out-of-court settlement for $1.5 million, which was donated to the Brotman Medical Center to establish a burn center in his name. Leaving the Jackson 5. 7 months after the Pepsi fire, the Jacksons kicked off their victory tour. It came to a close at Los Angeles' Dodger Stadium in December 1984. Marking the end of an era for Michael and his brothers, it was indeed during the final show that Michael solidified his departure from the group, announcing that it would be their last performance together. But several biographers have noted that the idea had been percolating for months, if not years, as Jackson enjoyed success in his solo career and sought to break away from the group. That was Michael, Fact versus Fiction, Peter Pan, The Pepsi Incident, and Michael Jackson's Relationship with His Dad, and it was by Shania Russell. Before we get to our next story, I'm going to take a quick break here to say that you are listening to Entertainment Weekly here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. Next, we have an article about Elizabeth Smart. She has won a bodybuilding competition. I am so proud of my body and I want to celebrate it. The kidnapping survivor took first place in the Fit Model Novice category at the Wasatch Warrior Competition in Salt Lake City. This is by Kathleen Perricone. Elizabeth Smart is showing her strength inside and out. The child safety advocate who survived a 2002 kidnapping as a teen won first place in the Fit Model Novice category at the Wasatch Warrior Bodybuilding and Fitness Competition in Salt Lake City over the weekend. It was actually her fourth time competing, but I was too afraid to post it before, Smart confessed in an Instagram caption. The image of the mom of three, looking svelte in a navy bikini and posing on stage, came as a shock to many of her followers, and Smart herself admitted, never in 100 years would she have ever envisioned doing something like this. As she explained, she had worried that publicizing her interest in bodybuilding might make people perceive her as unworthy to continue working as an advocate for all survivors. But after the competition, in which she also ranked third in the Fit Model Masters 35-plus category, the 38-year-old decided to reclaim her narrative as a survivor of sexual assault more than 2 decades after she was rescued from abductors Brian David Mitchell and Wanda Barzee. I am interested in many things, and as I get older, I realize more and more how important it is to make the most of today. We don't know what tomorrow brings, Smart explained in her Instagram caption. And I don't want to reach the end of my life and look back and feel regret for only living a half life, not going after all the things I want to do and try. This was a big change for me. It was hard. It pushed me, challenged me not to give up. In 2002, Smart was kidnapped from her bedroom and held captive by Mitchell and Barzee for 9 agonizing months, spent shackled and subjected to daily sexual assault. That's why now, competing as a bodybuilder provides a unique way of healing from the traumatic experience. I am so proud of my body, and I want to celebrate it, Smart said. My body has carried me through every worst day, every hellish, grueling experience. It's created and nurtured 3 beautiful children. My body has risen to every single challenge life has presented it with, and carried me through, so I refuse to be ashamed of it. I refuse to feel embarrassed about trying something new and am embracing my chance at life to the absolute fullest I can. This isn't the first time Smart has done something outside her comfort zone. In 2021, she competed on The Masked Dancer as Ms. Moth. When she got the call, she thought producers had the wrong number. I'm not a dancer. I've never trained. That's not my forte in life, Smart told Entertainment Weekly at the time. Her initial reaction was to say no, but her grandmother's recent passing made the young woman rethink her own life. She did a lot of really serious things, but she also had a lot of fun, Smart said. I feel like I've lived a pretty serious life, she acknowledged. I've dedicated really a lot of my life since I was rescued from being kidnapped to serious issues. So why not do something that's fun? Why not do something that brings a little bit of light to my life and maybe to people watching? That was Smart Wins Bodybuilding Competition, and it was by Kathleen Perricone. Donnie Wahlberg wants other Boston guys, Ben Affleck, Mark Wahlberg, and Matt Damon to appear on Boston Blue. Now, these would be some wicked cameos. Donnie Wahlberg is trying to manifest a bunch of wicked cool cameos for Boston Blue. The 56-year-old actor revealed that he'd love to have fellow Bostonians Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, and his very own brother, Mark Wahlberg, guest star on the popular Blue Bloods spin-off series in the future. I'd like to get some other Boston guys in it, Wahlberg said on Wednesday's episode of The Tonight Show. Let's see. Mark Wahlberg, maybe? I don't know. He don't want to act with me. To remedy the issue, host Jimmy Fallon noted that Mark didn't have to necessarily play himself on screen. He could play Marky Mark, he pitched, referencing Mark's past music career. Donnie was immediately on board. Like old retired Marky Mark, he replied, noting that this older version would likely be found selling hot dogs at the Celtics games. But the Good Vibrations performer isn't the only famous Bostonian on Donnie's Boston Blue Dream cast list. He also suggested Ben and Matt, better known as longtime pals Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, for a guest spot too. And heck, Donnie's even open to Fallon making an appearance on the show if he's interested. Now, you're not a Bostonian, but you do a good accent, he said. You would be a great guest. To which Fallon responded, I would love to do it. I'd love to do a Boston thing in there, anything. Boston Blue follows Detective Danny Regan, played by Donnie, as he bids farewell to New York City in order to take on a new position in the Boston Police Department. There, he teams up with Detective Lena Silver, played by Sonequa Martin-Green, to solve cases and attempts to reconnect with his rookie cop son, Sean, played by Mika Amundsen. While visiting The Tonight Show, Donnie explained that he finds himself accidentally slipping back into his Boston accent when playing native New Yorker Danny on the Boston set show. It happens more than before because I was surrounded by New Yorkers when I was playing Danny Regan in New York, he said. So I was constantly on my toes, and they'd laugh at me if Boston ever slipped out. He also said, the rest of the Blue Bloods cast would torment me whenever New York beat Boston in any sporting event. But I learned, he said, so now I do that to all the Boston characters in the show as a New Yorker. We can watch Donnie share his dream cast list and the whole conversation with Fallon in the clip that's linked in the article. That was Donnie Wahlberg wants other Boston guys, Ben Affleck, Mark Wahlberg, and Matt Damon, to appear on Boston Blue, and it was by Emlyn Travis. Pete Davidson debuts new tattoo after spending $200,000 to have others removed. Pete Davidson has mostly had less and less ink each time he's been photographed lately. The former Saturday Night Live star had a new tattoo, though, in photos from this month's CinemaCon 2026 at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. While Davidson's skin was mostly free of ink, he sported the name of his daughter, Scotty, written close to his ear. Entertainment Weekly has reached out to reps for Davidson. The star of Dumb Money and the upcoming How to Rob a Bank said in 2021 that he would be removing his tattoos over the next several years. He was 27 then, and he expected they would all be gone by the time he was 30. He's estimated that he's already spent $200,000 on the process. But it's taken more time and been more painful than he had anticipated. He's acknowledged that it's pretty horrible to undergo the removal procedure, which requires 6 weeks of healing before the next session. It's like putting your arm on a grill and burning off a layer, and then you gotta do maintenance and let it heal properly, Davidson told Variety in April 2025. And it's pretty tough. It sucks, I'm not gonna lie. He hadn't planned to get rid of all of his ink anyway, at least planning to keep a likeness of Hillary Clinton on his right leg, but most of it. But he'd said it was something he needed to do for his sobriety. The new tattoo has special meaning, however. Davidson and girlfriend Elsie Hewitt welcomed his first child, a daughter they named Scotty Rose Hewitt Davidson, on December 12th. Even before the little one's arrival, Davidson had said he was excited about his new role, especially because he lost his own father, a New York City firefighter, killed as a first responder to the September 11th attacks when he was 7. He was even more grateful after the birth. "Dad life is effing awesome," he told People in March. "It is exhausting and rewarding and cute. And I'm very lucky because Elsie is a fantastic mom, and I can't stress enough how lucky I am." That was Pete Davidson debuts new tattoo after spending $200,000 to have others removed, and it was by Rachel Schofield. Kind of a companion to that article, here Drew Barrymore and Zayn Malik get tattoos on her talk show. It's something I really need. This is by Emlyn Travis. Drew Barrymore and Zayn Malik just became tattoo twins. The Fever Pitch actress, 51, and Pillow Talk singer, 33, took their friendship to the next level by getting some new ink inspired by each other in a pre-recorded segment that aired on one of this week's episodes of The Drew Barrymore Show. "I started studying what your name means, and one of the words that it means is grace," Barrymore explained to Malik ahead of their appointment. "It's one of the tattoos I've always wanted because it's the thing I've got to start giving myself in a different way." It's also a perfect way to pay tribute to Malik's and her own mental health journey. She added, "Putting your name on my body in the form of grace, I think, is going to change my life for the better. It's something I really need." Malik, on the other hand, wasn't as subtle with his Barrymore-inspired tattoo. "I chose to get your name in Arabic," he revealed, causing Barrymore to giggle and kick her feet in the air from her own tattoo chair. "I'm so honored," she cheered as she pulled Malik into a hug. I'm so excited. I am so honored." Sitting back in her chair, she continued, "I'm very grateful because I hope that if and when you ever look at it, we can both just step back and maybe believe in the fact that we're trying so hard and giving so much. And where and when is it acceptable and necessary to put ourselves in the mix of all the priorities and care and all of that?" The pair continued to chat throughout their session until it was time to reveal the final products. "Have you looked at your tattoo yet?" Barrymore asked Malik. He responded, "Yeah, I have. It's really nice. It's clean lines." The camera cut to reveal the pair's tattoos with Barrymore's, quote, "grace" on the interior side of her wrist and Malik's "Drew" on his forearm just below a checkered flag tattoo. There's pictures in the article. "It's so perfect," she said, taking Malik's arm to see the finished product. She continued, "Can I see yours? Oh, it's so beautiful." The pre-recorded segment aired less than a week after Malik revealed that he'd been unexpectedly hospitalized due to an undisclosed illness on April 17th. His team later announced that the One Direction alum would miss several pre-scheduled fan appearances across the East Coast as a result. "To my fans, thank you to all of you for your love and support now and always. It's been a long week, and I am still unexpectedly recovering," Malik wrote on his Instagram story at the time. "Heartbroken that I can't see you all this week. I wouldn't be in the place I am today without you guys, and am so thankful for your understanding." The vocalist is still scheduled to embark on an area and stadium tour supporting his fifth album, Cunical, on May 12th. The 36-date concert series, which concludes in November, is Malik's first ever solo headlining tour across North America, South America, Mexico, and the United Kingdom. Barrymore and Malik's tattoo-infused interview also comes just days after UK tabloid The Sun reported that Malik punched fellow One Direction bandmate Lewis Tomlinson while they were filming their untitled Netflix docuseries together. Tomlinson has since unfollowed Malik on Instagram. Announced last October, the three-part docuseries was set to follow Tomlinson and Malik on a road trip throughout the U.S. and was described as a spontaneous adventure of reconnection, exploration, and a lot of laughter. The project would have seen the pair reunite to discuss One Direction, the years after the band's dissolution, and the unexpected death of their fellow bandmate, Liam Payne. The status of Malik and Tomlinson's docuseries remains unclear. Representatives for Netflix did not respond to Entertainment Weekly's request for comment. That was Drew Barrymore and Zayn Malik get tattoos on her talk show, and it was by Emlyn Travis. Michael B. Jordan and Austin Butler's Miami Vice movie will bring the action back to the 80s. The new film adaptation of the classic series will cruise into theaters on August 6, 2027. This is by Wesley Stenzel and Derek Lawrence. Miami Vice is going back to where it belongs, the 80s. After months of rumors, Michael B. Jordan and Austin Butler are officially set to star in Top Gun Maverick director Joseph Kosinski's adaptation of the beloved crime series titled Miami Vice 85. Inspired by the 1984 pilot episode and the first season of Miami Vice, the new film explores the glamour and corruption of mid-80s Miami. Jordan will portray Ricardo Rico Tubbs, while Butler will play James Sonny Crockett. Hailing from the filmmaker behind Maverick and F1, unsurprisingly, Miami Vice 85 will be filmed for IMAX. Kosinski previously found success reinterpreting 80s classics in Top Gun, Maverick, and Tron Legacy, and more recently earned a Best Picture Oscar nom for F1. His Miami Vice script will be written by Nightcrawler director Dan Gilroy, who recently won an Emmy for his work on season 2 of Andor. Miami Vice marks the first new project that Jordan has signed on to since taking home the Oscar for Sinners in March. Both Butler and Jordan will next be seen warming up for Miami Vice with their own crime dramas. Jordan is directing and starring in a new version of the Thomas Crown Affair, while Butler is facing off with Jeremy Allen White in the upcoming A24 film Enemies. Miami Vice premiered on NBC in 1984 and starred Don Johnson as Crockett and Philip Michael Thomas as Tubbs, South Florida detectives who are attracted to colorful suits and crimes. The show ran for 5 seasons and won 4 Emmys. Michael Mann, who executive produced the original series, directed a 2006 film adaptation which featured Colin Farrell as Crockett and Jamie Foxx as Tubbs. Initially a box office disappointment, it has gained a substantial cult following in the years since its release. Miami Vice will cruise into theaters on August 6, 2027. That was Michael B. Jordan and Austin Butler's Miami Vice movie will bring the action back to the 80s. It was by Wesley Stenzel and Derek Lawrence. Also coming in the future, maybe, definitely, Donald Glover promises the Community movie will happen soon. I know, everybody's been saying that. It's been 4 years since Peacock greenlit the continuation of the NBC sitcom. This is by Derek Lawrence. Donald Glover knows that fans are tired of being told that the Community movie is still happening, but he promises that this time he's telling the truth. It's been 11 years since the beloved sitcom concluded, and another 4 years since Peacock officially announced plans for a film continuation, and yet the 6 seasons in a movie prophecy has yet to be fulfilled. If Glover is to be believed, things are finally getting close. "We were just on the text chain talking about it," he told ET of conversations with his classmates about the revival. "We're working on it right now. I know everybody's been saying that forever, but I swear to you, I'm not lying about this. I really think it's something that's going to happen soon." The community team and its fans have been trying to will a movie into existence since the show was still on the air, with 6 seasons and a movie becoming a rallying cry after the line was first dropped in a season 2 episode by Abed, played by Danny Pudi. In the subsequent years, the cast and creator Dan Harmon have kept insisting that they're all game, and then class seemed back in session when Peacock ordered the film in 2022, but the cameras have still yet to roll. We got very close to shooting that, Community movie co-writer Andrew Guest recently revealed. As the writer's strikes and actor's strikes were ending in 2023, all of our cast were available. All of them wanted to do it. We had a line producer, we had a script that we were in the process of starting to rewrite, and one of our actors' projects sort of came in conflict in terms of timing. Joel McHale previously pointed to Glover's schedule as the biggest obstacle given the multi-hyphenate's various projects, but the Grammy-winning artist has pushed back on that notion. "Everyone is hating on me on the internet, and it's not me," he declared. "They're like, we know you're the reason. Maybe I was last year. Maybe, but not this time." Whenever it does happen, Community scene stealer Ken Young said of the script, "It made me emotional and just brought me right back." Sounds like it will be worth the wait. That was Donald Glover promises the Community movie will happen soon, and it was by Derek Lawrence. When we started, the must list mentioned Mother Mary, that's that movie, and I'm going to wrap up this episode with a story about Mother Mary. Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole felt supernatural energy on Mother Mary set. There were strange things going on. The co-stars recall strange light and other occurrences that mirrored the film's spooky vibes. This is by Tiffany Kelly. Mother Mary, David Lowery's moody new drama, sees Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole as estranged friends and collaborators who reunite after not speaking for several years. Hathaway's titular pop star and Cole's fashion designer, Sam Anselm, break down what happened between them, and along the way, the vibes became spooky. A Ouija board and a summoning circle come into play. On the set of the A24 film, the lead stars recall eerie, real-life occurrences that mirrored the story's mystical qualities. "I think there were a lot of magnetic things that were happening," Hathaway tells Entertainment Weekly. "You know, like somebody would think of something and then somebody else would bring it in. And those two people wouldn't have talked. So there's a lot of connective coincidence that was going on." Meanwhile, Cole stayed in a castle while filming Mother Mary, which gave off an interesting energy. The barn that production designer Francesca Di Mottola built, which serves as part of Sam's atelier, and the backdrop for a large portion of the film also gave off a supernatural energy within it, says Cole. "I started having relationships with the mannequins and the stairs and the rolls of fabric. It became my home, and I didn't want to leave it," the "I May Destroy You" creator shares. Hathaway also remembers a period of a few days where the light outside the barn felt kind of mystical and wonderful. "Michaela and I took a couple days to figure out what it felt like," recalls Hathaway. And then Michaela said, "It's like we're in the horizon." So strange light, strange feelings, the actress who next appears in The Devil Wears Prada 2 adds, "There were strange things going on." However, Hathaway clarifies, while strange things happened, nothing was unpleasant. A lot of it was actually quite beautiful. Lowery, who previously wrote and directed A Ghost Story and The Green Knight, didn't experience any unusual phenomena himself, but he says crew members texted him about odd events. I know that something was afoot. Although he's now made several films that involve ghosts, the filmmaker has yet to encounter an otherworldly being in his off-screen life. "I'm a seeker," he tells Entertainment Weekly. "I'm always open. I'm trying to put my antenna up and say to any phenomena that exists that I would love to make contact. I've yet to meet a ghost. I've yet to become a true believer, but I'm very open to it." Mother Mary had been in select theaters, but it's now open nationwide, and there's an official trailer that's linked at the end of this article. That was Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole. Felt supernatural energy on Mother Mary's set, and it was by Tiffany Kelly. So that finishes up my stories for this week, and I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Before we go, I wanted to mention something that's on the Sun Sounds of Arizona webpage, that is sunsounds.org, sunsounds.org. When you first bring up the website, there's a survey out there as I'm recording this. It says Sun Sounds Voice Survey. At Sun Sounds, we believe every voice matters, especially yours. To help us grow and serve you better, we're inviting listeners, volunteers, and community members to participate in the Sun Sounds Voice Survey. By participating, you play an important role in strengthening a service that connects people to news, information, and entertainment they might not otherwise access. Your feedback helps ensure Sun Sounds continues to be responsive, inclusive, and grounded in the needs of our community. You can access the survey using the link available here. We encourage you to take a few moments to share your thoughts and help us continue improving our services. And then there's the link to Sun Sounds Voice Survey. So please, if you have a chance, take the survey by going to the website sunsounds.org. Okay, that's a wrap for us for this week's episode of Entertainment Weekly. Please come back next week and there will be more articles. There was a really good article about a list of time travel movies, but I just did not have time for it. I'll put it at the top of my list for next week, so there's a teaser for you. Until then, I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you all for listening. Until next week, goodbye.